say this is your obscenity warning. Come on, take it from the top.
Hi, my name is Lily Leibovitz, and my dad and his friends like to say stupid, poopy, farty, and other bad words.
This is your obscenity warning. Into the mic, say this is your obscenity warning.
This is your obscenity warning.
Thank you.
Yay!
Brava! Brava!
Out you go.
This is Unorthodox, the world's leading Jewish podcast. I am your host, Mark Oppenheimer, joined this week by senior writer Leah Leibowitz.
Hello to you.
And deputy editor Stephanie Butnick.
Hello.
Our Jews of the week. We are Jew plentiful this week.
We're Jew mournful this week.
We are Jew mournful this week. More on that in a moment. But let's just get out there that we'll be joined by Jonathan Ornstein, director of JCC Krakow. For all of your Pilates and Rummy Cub needs in Krakow, Jonathan Ornstein will be here to tell us what it's like to run a Jewish community center in a city and country that have had a complicated relationship with their Jewish residents over the years.
I like it's like the Facebook coalition.
It's complicated.
It's complicated.
Jews in Poland, it's complicated.
I think that's what my thesis was called.
We'll also be joined by Gabby Berkner and Rebecca Sofer of Modern Loss. Modern Loss is a website, book, virtual community, IRL community. It's a community of people talking about how to deal with mourning, especially for younger people, for people in their 20s and 30s who may be experiencing unexpected loss of parents, partners, and so forth. They are amazing, and we're very excited to talk to them.
It's mourning in America.
But it's mourning with a U, because the holiday coming up this weekend is... Is it a holiday? It's a minor fast day.
There's no such thing as a minor fast day.
I believe that theologically this is a minor fast day. Shira confirmed. Shira Talushkin,
it's a minor fast day. You can like have smoothies.
It's the 17th of Tammuz. Yud Zayin Tammuz, a dawn to dusk minor fast day. Only dawn to dusk. That's why it's minor, right? It's not the full 24 hours. And no, seriously, it kicks off the 3 weeks of mourning before Tisha B'Av, otherwise known as the weeks when the New York Times wedding pages are relatively Jew-free because you're not supposed to get married during those weeks. It's the lead up to Tisha B'Av, which is the destruction of the temple.
Mm-hmm. It's the day that the walls were breached.
Right. According to the Mishnah, five things happened to our ancestors on 17th Tammuz. The tablets of the Holy Law were broken. Continual sacrifice ceased. Jerusalem was stormed. Something about an idol being placed in the temple. And it was
Seinfeld was canceled.
Anyway, for those of you, I think it'd be really interesting if some of our listeners who are maybe have not Yom Kippur fasted in a while, this is your stepping stone. This is your gateway, your gateway drug. Do a minor fast.
Like a training.
Do a bissel of fasting. I've told this story before, but it is worth mentioning that one of my favorite stories I ever wrote was when I covered the large evangelical megachurch in Jacksonville, Florida, that was fasting for 30 days. And it turned, because evangelicals love to fast, but it turns out they don't really fast. They were doing, the preacher of this megachurch was doing a smoothie fast.
Yeah, a juice cleanse, if you will.
Where he was eating only smoothies. And here I was, this Jewish reporter. They had me in their green room because he had one of those shows, like it was a megachurch. They literally had a green room. Before he went on stage, and he was in the green room telling me with his smoothies. And I was like, bruh, like, I thought you were fasting. He's like, well, I mean, I can't fast for 30 days. It's smoothie fast.
It's like literally welcome to being a woman in America.
Plus, where I come from, people charge you like $130 a day for this exact
this full experience.
So, what is up, Jews? Stephanie Butnick, how's your week been?
My week has been good. I finally looked up from my phone while I was outside our office on 6th Avenue, and I realized there's this like tiny string on the from the lamppost to the lamppost, and I was like, oh my god, have I been walking through an Erev every day on my way to work for the past 7 years and just never noticed? And so I looked it up, and like NYC Erev is a very legit thing. It goes all around the city. On 6th Avenue from Bleecker Street to 55th, but it's only on the east side of the street. It's like, this is this whole amazing thing. So the Erev is basically what allows people, particularly women, I imagine, to either push a stroller on Shabbat or to hold items.
Right, because you're not allowed to carry on Shabbat. Yeah. But if you're within an Erev, you're technically within your spiritual house, the metaphorical house.
It's my favorite Jewish loophole of all of them.
So interestingly...
Yeah, can we do an Erev for like bacon? Like, you're already in your spiritual thing. You could have that cheeseburger.
It's like
here.
What happens in the Erev.
You know, there's no Erev on my wife's ancestral homeland of the Lower East Side.
Correct.
Because the descendants of Reb Moshe Feinstein don't believe that you're allowed to put up a string and say that if you're within the string, it's your house.
They're like, that's
and therefore you can push a stroller or carry a coat or whatever. So therefore, whenever like young hipster observant Jews move to the Lower East Side, as soon as they get more than a couple kids, they have to leave because you can't really take a big family outside without an Eruv. Mm-hmm. And every other Orthodox Jew in the world signs on to this loophole except this little tiny clique on the Lower East Side who make sure that their alderman or selectman or counselor won't let the public utilities put up an Eruv. So they're actually murdering Jewish life on the Lower East Side.
It's like Life of Brian. We're not the people's Judean front. We're the Judean front of
Judah. The people. Yeah. Exactly.
Amazing.
So you just discovered the nomad Eruv, basically. Yeah. The Flatiron Eruv.
I mean, it just shows that like I just have not ever looked up.
Amazing.
Liel, can you top that?
I just
discovered there's Jewish life in Midtown. What do you got?
I discovered Jewish summer camp. Writ large. Okay. So my kids go to the JCC, which we love.
Oh, we know.
Hudson still goes there. But Lily this year is starting Camp Satoga, which is a JCC camp, you know, upstate. Now, some of our listeners may remember my stories about summer camp, which involved eating off a door that I tore off of a latrine.
Yeah.
That was like your table.
That's right.
To use as a table slash oven slash
bed.
Bed slash, you know, wash basin.
Yeah.
Like literally my summer camp was a field. It was like you could use part of it to play, part of it to
eat.
It was
a field with barbed wire around part
of
the perimeter.
A field of dreams.
Just stay here,
it was sort of like, you know, Hogan's Heroes. in the Galilee.
That's the camp it was about.
Their summer camp is the most amazing thing. It has a parkour station.
Are we still doing parkour?
Oh, we're still doing parkour. Wow. It has a gymnastics station. It has like a rappelling slash zip lining, wall climbing. It is literally the most incredible thing I have seen. And I really, if they admitted me, I'm quitting this gig.
You're quitting the show.
And I'm just going there like year
Your
long.
Your calling actually might be camp director, Liel.
There's a problem here because the problem would be hygiene, because the way we were trained
Yours?
With summer camp in Israel,
yeah, that's right.
Not so much mine as
you would
some,
shower from September to June.
The standards to which you
Mark,
have.
Literally, and this is Israel. I mean, consider the right. temperatures and everything. Literally, we would shower maybe twice a summer. It's disgusting. This is like
they were
the world
we need
I
to
came
save the
from.
Water.
Yeah,
you came back and like you walked into town and everyone was like, no. I don't think I would, you know.
Well,
but you know what?
That.
When you say camp, can I tell you what that reminds me of?
What's that?
Our amazing Camp Unorthodox 2018 special edition t-shirts, part of our fundraiser.
Right.
I'm shilling for it. They're like in the camp font. It's like literally like the log font.
Yep.
They are a thing
and
of
it's
great
so
beauty.
Good. And you, it's the our reward at the $72 level.
I'm so glad that you're actually shilling for this because, you know, I've always done these ads the last 2 years. And the reality is, if we're to judge from our mailbox at all, like people like me fine, but nobody's obsessive about me. Like nobody's going to give money because Mark Oppenheimer, nobody feels they have to give money because Mark said it. Whereas Liel's fans, they would enlist in the IDF for you. Your fans would, Stephanie Sins would adopt a cat for her. Like you,
can they
you
adopt
have,
mine?
You have more obsessive fans than I do. So,
Mark, don't
you
know sell what? Yourself
yeah,
short.
I don't know that that's true at all.
I'm just reading the mail.
Your fans are quieter because they're, yeah. you know, normal. People.
Your
Ours
fans have like
just...
savings accounts that they can donate from.
That's
they have
right.
IRA. They have IRAs. Actually, they can't. The money's protected in an IRA. They can't touch it till they're 62.
Your fans are IRA. My fans are NRA. You know, it's human life services. But
my
you know,
fans are OMG.
Your fans are OMG. But I have a modest proposal, if you will. Let's put this theory to the test.
Okay, how are we going to do that?
This fan showdown.
Okay,
let's see. Let's actually take it to the fans, guys. Here's what we're going to do. If you like the show, and you do,
and you do,
you're listening to us now, give us money, which is how we, you know, keep the show going, which is a really good thing to do to help your favorite right.
TabletMag.com/donate.
Correct. But here's what you have to do. In the notes for your donation, put one name. It could either be Mark, Stephanie, or Liel, spelled L-I-E-L. And
Mark with a K.
And we're going to turn this into a competition. And because it's us.
Okay, what should we do?
Yeah, because it's us. Okay. I think that the person.
I like where this is going.
The person who gets the most, whatever. The person in the middle, whatever. The person who gets the least people.
The loser.
The loser.
Yeah.
The loser.
The loser.
The person who gets the
Low
least
energy.
People to donate money and write their name in the note yeah. Line has to do something mortifyingly out of character.
So like if.
On air.
So. On air?
No. Yes.
Well, or we could record. Because here's
record
my idea. Because
yeah.
as we know from past episodes, Stephanie, despite being one of the leading Jews in America, refuses to put a mezuzah on her door.
Well, I don't want anyone to know.
She doesn't
want
to be made by the anti-Semites or the cool kids. So I think if she loses.
Oh, my God.
I think if she loses, we get to go to her apartment, the two of us.
Together with 36 yeshiva boichers.
Yes, with lubavitchers.
And the mitzvah tank.
You're going to nail in the West Village. On my door?
We're going to nail a mitzvah to your door as we blare out like Mashiach.
Yes.
Okay.
We're going to have a lubavitcher Winnebago in the street in the village as we nail a mitzvah to your door.
You are going to go to a Belgian restaurant. You're going to eat a Belgian waffle. You're going to eat all those, like, you're going to eat all this Belgian food.
I will do
while
one
wrapped
more.
In a Belgian flag.
I will go to an official consulate and/or embassy of Belgium, which, as you know, is the child rape capital of the world.
You'll get Belgian sensitivity training
and
from their
consul. And I will get Belgian sensitivity training from a Belgian official for a whole day.
All right. Well, this is good. We've settled this.
Well, hey, no, Mark, what are we going to do with you? I think Mark is going to have to take his entire family plus us to a movie at the time that movies cost the most.
And pay.
No senior discounts.
3D.
No, yeah, IMAX.
We would click the machine ourselves. Yeah. Like, plus.
I want an extra large popcorn. I want drinks. I want jujubes. I want all the candy.
All right. Good deal. All right. So listeners.
I like this. So now we've gamified our. Don't drive.
Every other show just lets you do good things and feel good with your money. We need us to feel good. We bring spite into it. There's an element of punishment.
This is why we can't have nice things.
We can't have nice things, because we lose. Duo Dickinson gave us $50. Two-time Gentile of the Week.
I like when guests give. That makes me happy.
Juna Grossman. Yeah, Molly Ye gave a bit. Amia Kaur's Anonymous. Juna Grossman, Anonymous. I mean, Ashley Fleming. I just want to say, can I quote Ashley Fleming? She says, Unorthodox is my happy place. In times like these, we all need more of Mark, Stephanie, and Liel.
Aww.
And then Ken Mercer just wrote, my audio conscience. That could be a t-shirt, like Unorthodox. Your audio conscience.
My favorite one said, I don't give to my synagogue drive, but I do give to the Unorthodox drive.
I felt a little bad about that. It's like, we're taking money
out of
this.
We are the Yom Kippur appeal.
We are the Yom Kippur
appeal. Suck it, Rabbi.
So it is on talentmag.com/donate. What is up, Jews, in the world at large? Some news of the Jews, perhaps?
This is Tuesday.
Yeah.
We record on Tuesday mornings, as people who listen to the show know.
Ken.
And tonight... I think that, television would air what is arguably the pinnacle of American entertainment, I want to say ever, an episode of Drunken History, which is a really funny show on Comedy Central where a drunk celebrity tells a story from history and then other celebrities reenact it in a funny way. The celebrity du jour is our beloved Rachel Bloom, who drunkenly tells the story of the Eichmann abduction. And who plays Eichmann?
I couldn't tell who that was. I saw the clip on YouTube.
It is Weird Al Yankovic.
What?
Oh, that's who that was.
And to top that, if you only could, Tony Hale, who plays Buster in Arrested Development,
who's so funny.
And also in Veep.
Veep, yeah.
Plays Isser Harel, the legendary head of the Mossad.
And Isser Harel is like, awesome. We're going to hunt down Nazi war criminals, because there are a lot of Nazis still, like, chilling. And the guy at the top of their list is Adolf Eichmann, who literally planned the Holocaust. So Isser Harel is like, let's nail this f***ing motherfucker to the wall like a f***ing moose who's been hunted.
At the end, as she is sort of drunkenly falling off the sofa, she's like, I'm 97.4% Ashkenazi, bitch.
I have to say, like, I didn't know a lot of the stuff that was in there.
Yeah, I learned. That's what I would show my class if I were teaching the Eichmann abduction.
Argentina's really bad about extraditing Nazis. They, like, don't give a shit for some reason. I don't know why, but they're just bad about it. And he tells Viharoni, if we're gonna capture Adolf Eichmann, we're gonna have to like fool and kidnap him, like a kid on a milk carton. We're gonna have to milk carton Adolf Eichmann. Mm.
Well, I'm thrilled that your news of the Jews is that a funny video is debuting on Comedy Central. Is there any more substantial news of the Jews? Anyone, quickly?
Oh, there was another El Al incident, wasn't there?
Oh, that's right.
It's the El Al of the week.
Then there was another.
There was a Haredi man refusing to sit next to a woman on some airline.
Actually, according to the Jewish Telegraphic Agency, 4 Haredi men refused to sit next to a woman. How would all 4 of them? Oh, I guess they tried them serially and each said, no, woman, Isha, on an El Al flight from New York to Israel. And then the Israeli rapper... who goes by the moniker Sagol 59. Do you know this guy? Is he big?
He was like on the plane too?
He was on the plane. And he actually pointed out in talking about it on social media that after all of the women were kicked out of their seats and harassed and degraded for being women, they didn't even get bumped up to first class. They had to stay in economy.
Oh, wait, so this was four different women. It wasn't like they tried to get, like, there's just women all over the plane that were just, you know, offending
men. Can you imagine
the
women all over the plane?
How
not,
dare
not in
they?
Their own section?
According to Seagull 59.
Just wherever they want?
According to rapper Seagull 59, one of the four Haredi Orthodox men, who was, quote, particularly devout and ascetic, got on the plane with his eyes closed so he wouldn't see the women. And he was led by the hand of one of the other men and remained that way throughout the flight. So that's what, like a 7-hour flight?
Just holding hands.
It's an 11-hour flight. But you know what? I'm going to try that next time. I'm just going to get it, like, with my eyes closed, be like, hi.
Here's what I think. If you don't want to sit next to a, like, if you have an issue with sitting next to someone, you need to buy two seats. Buy
three.
Buy three seats. Get
three
that
seats.
Whole row to yourself. Because it's like, you, this boils my blood. Like, this is such bullshit. You can't just go on an airplane and be like, oh, I actually don't want to sit next to that person. But did I ever tell you guys this, that when I was on a plane to visit my sister in Israel when she was living there, I was taking a Yiddish class, my intro to Yiddish class at the Workman's Circle. What up, Kolya? Amazing, amazing instructor. And there were all these, like, Orthodox children that were sitting in my row, and they were speaking Yiddish, and I understood enough to understand a child speaking Yiddish, and they were literally saying, "I don't want to sit next to her."
Yeah.
none of the kids. It was gender.
The girls didn't want to sit next to you.
No one wanted to sit next to me. And then I took out my iPad and started playing Scrabble, and all of a sudden I was like a freaking Pied Piper of like Haredi children, just like
it's standing. Like
they were standing in the aisle, and
what
I was like, "Oh, now you guys want to sit next to me?"
Well, from bad to worse, I just want to quote my friend. This story. Al, fortunately, you didn't give us the worst news of the week. This is, I'll read from my friend Dan Friedman at The Forward. British university uses Nazi quote to inspire students. The career advice department at University of Exeter on the southwest coast of England sent out an inspirational quote in a mass email. Quote, one cannot permit unique opportunities to slip by for the sake of trifles. But as local newspaper The Falmouth Packet reports, I should have done this in a British accent.
The Falmouth Packet.
The inspiration they are drawing on comes from Nazi General Erwin Rommel. According to the BBC, the university has issued an apology. Quote, this was a genuine error and in no way intentional. However, we apologize, with an S, unreservedly for any offense it may have caused, and have put additional processes in place to ensure this doesn't happen again. What are the additional processes you put in place to ensure that you don't send out Nazi quotes in the future?
You install Google in every computer in the university so you can freaking Google a quote before you put it on.
This does remind me that I was at a SoulCycle class last night, and the instructor was
from
like...
From Workman's Circle to SoulCycle.
Yeah, well, yeah, I'm just
the Stephanie Butnick story.
No, I was like... She was like, okay, now add some resistance. Add some more resistance. If not now, when? And I'm like, yes. Our Jewish guest this week comes to us all the way from Poland. Jonathan Ornstein is the executive director of the JCC Krakow, which boasts more than 10,000 visitors a month. I was one of them way back a few years ago.
I was one of them too.
Jonathan, thank
you. I'm feeling so left out.
Mark, we'll get you there. Thank you for being with us.
Pleasure to be with you guys.
So I imagine you're not what people expect of a JCC Krakow director. I will tell you that when I met you in Poland 2011, I would say, the first thing you said to me was you made fun of my alma mater, Duke University.
Sorry about that.
And I was like, I didn't come to Poland to be insulted, to be mocked about Duke. So you're like, because you're from here, right?
I am from here. I'm from New York, and I apologize for mocking you.
So how'd you get to Poland?
How'd you get to Krakow, man, from Queens?
Isn't it obvious? The Queens to Krakow is not the obvious path to take.
It is not.
I went to, sort of blew off my American life, went to Israel, made Aliyah, was living on a kibbutz, was a lone soldier on the kibbutz. After the army deciding if I should stay or go, met a Polish woman, volunteer on the kibbutz, and just picked up. Sight unseen, never been to Poland, and picked up and moved there. And that was in 2001. Then I...
Did you know what you were going to do for work?
No idea.
You were just going to be a house... You were basically going to be a kept man.
Exactly.
In Poland.
He landed. He's like, oh, you're Jewish. Do you want to run the JCC?
Yes, exactly. So then I came to Krakow. It didn't work out with her. We broke up, but I fell in love with Krakow. I was teaching at the university there.
You left her for Krakow?
I left her for Krakow. Well, once you see Krakow, you'll understand why.
What had you been doing for the 10 years between moving there and getting the job?
So it was about 7 years. I was teaching Hebrew at the university.
Got
at
it.
The Jewish Studies Department, which is a lot of non-Jews studying Hebrew, which was
is it even in, so here at a school where non-Jews are studying Hebrew, it's often evangelical Christians, but they don't have many of those in Poland.
Like, no.
Who was was it people who felt bad about what their great-grandparents did to the Jews?
No, no. These are young Polish non-Jews who felt that the country lost something when the Jews were murdered and then kicked out and then driven underground and wanted to learn something about this almost vanished people, this almost vanished culture.
How many Jews are there in Poland? Depends how you count, right?
Yeah, depends how you count. The official, in the guidebooks, it says there are about 120 Jews in Krakow, and we have 700 Jewish members at the JCC. So all the number, you can throw all the numbers out the window. I would say, if we'd say by law of return, if we look at how many Poles today have a Jewish grandparent, I'd say it's probably about 100,000.
Wow.
Which is an order of magnitude higher than any of the official numbers.
I was about to say, there are 700 Jews in my building. Like, literally.
Right.
So what's your community like? I mean, who are the people who make it up? How old are they?
So it's Holocaust survivors, Polish Jews who survived and then stayed, never left Poland. And there are a lot of young people, which is really interesting, that are finding out they're Jewish. For example, people that grew up without knowing they're Jewish, and then they find out in all different ways. Someone finds a box in their grandparents' attic with black and white photos. They start looking at them. People with long beards, they realize there weren't any Amish in Poland in 1939. Something else might be going on, and start the process and figure out that they're Jewish. So stuff like really interesting stuff is going on. A lot of young people involved.
And I imagine the JCC is sort of the central, the locus for that kind of activity, right?
Absolutely. That's why we were set up to be a magnet to draw these people, the young people that are finding out they're Jewish and bring
them
back.
Do you have like a kit by now?
Like so, a pamphlet?
So congratulations. So you're Jewish.
You discovered a black and white photo in the attic. Here's what to do next.
Here's the good and the bad.
Right.
Right. A quick guide to assuming all the guilt. You know, you have to get people up to speed. It takes a while.
The guilt, the fear, the history, all of it. Why is there a JCC in Krakow, given all the decades of pretty sleepy Jewish life in Krakow?
There is a JCC because Prince Charles actually came to visit us in Krakow, and he met with some survivors in 2002, and he was very moved that he wanted to help them. And the original idea was doing a senior citizen center. And then a couple of Jewish organizations, World Jewish Relief and The Joint here in the United States, realized that there was something else going on, that there were young people starting to find out they were Jewish. So they went back to the prince with an idea, instead of doing something only for senior citizens, let's do something with a broader mandate to try to bring these young people in. Prince Charles said, okay. And then they were able to raise the money and build the JCC. So in 2008, Prince Charles came and opened the JCC.
It's funny because that happened in New Haven as well. Although actually it was actually Queen Elizabeth who came and opened our JCC. So did he actually cut a check? I mean, what did he do besides
show up
in a double-breasted suit?
No, he did. He made a donation. And then with the prince's involvement, they were able to raise more money, as you would imagine. And then he came out with the Camilla, with the Duchess of Cornwall, and spent the day with us in 2008.
Oh, this was 2.0.
So,
yes, exactly. Diana.
No.
So I don't mean to you know, offend your lovely city or to suggest in any way that Warsaw is cooler, which I'm not saying here at all. But one does often get a feeling, spending some time in Krakow, that there is a, how shall we say it mildly, a Disney-fied element of Jewish life and memory. I mean, there are a lot of places and cafes where you go and there's this kind of like, look, kind of like shtetl chic vibe of like, here's a guy playing, you know,
Tevye walking by.
Right. Yeah. And so how do you guys, as like a real, actual, bona fide, authentic community structure, deal with a strong tourist magnet attitude?
It helps. It helps. And I'll tell you why. If there wasn't a Jewish community going on, and the only thing that there was this sort of, you know, we call it Jurassic Park, right? Because especially because it was after Spielberg came and filmed Schindler's List, it kickstarted it, so it works on a couple different levels. Mm-hmm. I think it would be sad. It would be Epcot. Yeah, it would be. But the fact is, these young people are finding out they're Jewish, and when they do it in Krakow, and there's all this Jewish kitschy stuff going on, I think it shows that there's this tremendous amount of non-Jewish interest in all things Jewish, and it makes those young people more likely to walk into a building like ours. So I might not want to eat in these restaurants with, you know, kosher style pork and things like this going on. But I think they're serving a purpose. And, you know, when you get beyond the kitsch and there's some, you know, a real revival going on, that's pretty remarkable.
I spent the summer in Poland a few years ago on a fellowship through the Auschwitz Jewish Center, which is an amazing organization I've talked about before. But when I went, my great aunt, who is Polish and a Holocaust survivor, said, "Why are you going to Poland?" And when I called her from there, she's like, "Watch your bag, make sure." And then, but also the young people I knew, everyone sort of was like, why are you going to Poland? And I came back and I said, this place is amazing. Krakow is incredible. There's so much life here and it's so interesting what's happening. And so how do you sort of square the general Jewish perception that like there's no reason to go to Poland? It's, you know, don't go to Poland, don't go to Germany. The sort of lumping together of these things, all of that.
Yeah, I mean, we have a problem when people lump Germany together with Poland, and then we see that recently with the Holocaust bill and all this. Yeah. There's issues with that. But in terms of Poland is a place, Poland is a country with three Jewish chapters. There's the Holocaust that we all know about, but there's 1,000 years of Jewish life before the Holocaust, and now there's Jewish life thriving once again. And I think that the tragedy of the Holocaust is the backdrop to what's going on today. And it's worth, of course, going and visiting the camps and learning about the Holocaust. But what is a more beautiful, important thing to see than Jewish life flourishing, you know, in the shadow of Auschwitz?
But Poland now has this right-wing government that has, what, the law says that you're not allowed to talk about. Yeah. You can explain the law to me. What is this new law that everyone's so worried about?
Yeah, the government is a right-wing populist government. The Holocaust bill is a misguided, poorly worded bill but I think had much less to do with Jews than it did with trying to protect the Polish self-image of being victims and heroes and being uncomfortable with dealing with more difficult aspects of their own history.
The bill criminalizes attributing the Holocaust to Poland, saying...
Well, there's no reason to attribute the Holocaust
complicity
to Poland.
But it's also a way of getting people to stop, say, Polish concentration camp, right? That's sort of like the crux, this idea that the concentration camps were in Poland, many of them, but they were not Polish. Like, that is an incorrect phrase.
Right. We, you know, a little bit is linguistic, and not to go too deep, too much of a deep dive, but when we say, for example, when we say New York deli, it can be a New York-style deli in Boise, Idaho, or it can be a Korean deli in New York. Mm-hmm. Right? But when you say, so with Polish, when Poles hear the term Polish concentration camps, the Polish language doesn't work that way. It's not a locative, right? So it doesn't mean in Poland, which is the way that we might hear it. It means of Poland, of the Polish. So that's why they get that upset about it.
Do you find yourself being an ambassador of sorts when you come back here? Like, is all your time in New York spent? Like, are you just trying to have a sandwich?
Go to Poland.
And instead you have to give some sort of, you know, soliloquy about why Poland is cool.
Eating a lot of pizza and being an ambassador, giving a lot of soliloquies.
These are the two things that you do.
Primary. No, absolutely. Absolutely. There's a lot of misinformation out there, but also a lot of people visit. We had over 120,000 visitors last year, and, you know, that's all different synagogues and federations. You know, these days, everybody in the last few years has made it a point not only to come to Poland to see the camps, but to see the history. They opened a wonderful museum of history of Polish mm-hmm. Jews in Warsaw, yep. which is a phenomenal must-see
place.
We
visited it.
Exactly.
We loved it.
And then to come and see Jewish life. So it's a story. I'll tell you what, in all the years that I've been doing it, in 10 years that we've been open, it's gotten much, much easier because people have visited and people have come back and told their friends. And it's not like, it's much less often, oh my God, there are Jews in Poland. It's more, oh wow, yeah, my cousin visited you and said they had a great time.
So here's the important question, if I may. In America, you know, every self-respecting JCC has a gym. It has Zumba classes.
Maybe a pool.
There's a pool. What do you got for programming there?
Yeah, none of the above. So we're a lot of the J in the JCC. We're very Jewish. So we have a preschool that we just opened, which is the first Jewish community kindergarten to open in 70 years. Hillel is run through the JCC. We just opened it. We're the youngest Hillel in the world, opened in June. We have BBYO run through the JCC. We have a Sunday school. We have Shabbat dinners every week. We have a genealogist on staff. We have Hebrew classes, Arabic classes, Yiddish classes. We publish a newspaper. We have a choir. We have Holocaust survivors. We're the primary agency taking care of 60 Holocaust survivors that are in the JCC every day for until 8:30 at night. So we're very busy.
Don't need a pool.
They went in like a radical different directions. Like, right. Zumba's cool. You know what else we could do?
Judaism.
We could do Judaism.
We could do Judaism.
What about the theme of the JCC be just being a Jewish community center?
Although we'd like a pool, right. I should say.
Prince Charles,
Prince, yeah.
I know you're listening.
So are you ever coming back to the United States?
You know, never say never. I'm here all the, you know, people ask if I miss New York, but I'm here every 2 or 3 months, so it's hard to miss it when you get back that often. But, I don't know. I've been in Krakow for a while. I love it. I think it's one of the most beautiful cities in the world, but you never know where life's going to take you.
Jonathan Ornstein, Executive Director of the JCC Krakow. Thank you for being our Jew of the Week.
And how do we find out more about the JCC, maybe help you guys out?
You can go to jcckrakow.org or to our 501c3 friends of jcckrakow.org. We raise our entire budget based on donations. So if you have any incredibly wealthy listeners out there, go and do the right thing.
Be like Prince Charles. Be like Chuck.
Exactly.
Thank you so much, Jonathan.
Thank you.
Thank you.
mnie pół Warszawy zna. Kto żył pięć lat, jest ze mną za pan brat. Więc mnie to bawiło, było nawet miło, gdy tu i tam refrenik brzmiał ten sam. Danula, Danula, futerko się otula. Danula, Danula, dziś na dancingu hula. Zlatam nóżki tej dziewuszki i piosenki wszystkie. Danula, Danula, popatrzeć proszę chciej.
All right, we have a double trouble Jewish guest. Double header. I don't know. We've got two Jewish guests this week.
Two-thirds of the Jewish Charlie's Angels.
Exactly. Yeah. We are here with We are here with Rebecca Sofer and Gabby Berkner. And
is that, by the way, I'm sorry, the collective term? A trouble of Jews?
Let me do this intro. You guys are being a real trouble of Jewish guys. Rebecca Sofer and Gabby Berkner are the co-founders of Modern Loss, a site that aims to make conversations about grief more candid, real, and less fraught and awkward. So Rebecca and Gabby, can you tell us a little bit about how you started this site?
Well, sure. This is Rebecca. We started the site more than 4.5 years ago. And the reason we launched it is because both of us went through some pretty profound loss, pretty crappy loss at a younger age than either one of us would have anticipated going through it. And we just realized very, very quickly on our own and then together that there was just this huge white space in terms of, you know, an honest, open, no holds barred, snarky, humorous exchange on the long arc of grief.
Gabby, when you and I talked, you had a very interesting kind of metaphor to describe what grief felt like to you. You said it was a little bit like a game of Candyland.
Yeah, I mean, in the Jewish tradition, you have these like, you have this calendar set out for you. There's this liminal period before burial and the 7 days of Shiva and the 30 days of Shloshim. You have a year of Kaddish, at which point you're kind of expected to be in a different place, and you may be, but you may not be. And the way I experience grief and the way many people in our book experience grief is that it's not such a linear process. It's more like a game of Candyland where you think you're approaching the castle or whatever is at the end, and then somehow you pick up a gumdrop and then you're at square one or square gumdrop.
So you guys, you both suffered, you know, tremendous personal loss that obviously spurred the creation of the site. Is it hard to talk about that suffering in a professional context? And will you tell us at the same time?
And whether it is or not, will you tell us what happens?
Sure. Is it hard to sort of perform those stories?
I mean, yeah, I think it's very safe to at least speak for Gabby when I say that neither one of us probably set out in life to do this as a project, be it right. Full-time or part-time.
You know what would be cool?
Yeah, I wasn't like 6 years old.
If you lost
old,
our parents
like,
traumatically
you know
and then made a career out of it.
I lost everyone I loved early and then just like honored them for the rest of my life. That just wasn't my plan. You know, I was working, you know, I was 30. I was working in daily TV. I was working for the Colbert Report, which, as you know, you might imagine when you're working in a daily production, it's a grind. You're 30. Your foot is like very hard on the gas pedal of life. You're working crazy hours. You're going out hard, trying to maybe meet somebody, maybe trying to afford like a larger apartment at some point in New York City. And I was doing all those things. And then my parents and I went on a family camping trip. And right after dropping me off that night in my apartment, they continued on to Philadelphia, where that's my hometown. And less than an hour later, I got a phone call that there had been a terrible accident on the New Jersey Turnpike, which, as you can all imagine, you know, is like a highly, highly, highly insulting place for, you know, something like this to happen to a loved one. Any place is insulting, but right, that's just beyond. And I'm a Philadelphian, yeah. So like terrible. And, you know, I heard my dad, he was screaming in the background. And, you know, I was told to rush down there and immediately found out what I knew as soon as I got that phone call, which was that my mom had not survived this car accident. My dad was in the car with her. And thus began my, you know, injection into this world of grief. And 3 years after my mom died, my dad died. He had a heart attack. So I was freshly 34. I was freshly married. And
you're
so
an orphan.
There. I was, an
orphan. An only child.
Yep.
And I thank God so much as I get older. And my parents, thank God, are so well and have another 30 years in them, I hope. But 40. My mother would be insulted that I'm saying she only has 30 years left.
Right.
She's 74. But I think of having siblings as such an extraordinary comfort should anything happen to my parents. I can't. Do you feel, when you look around at your friends with siblings, do you feel that it was harder for you as an only child? Does that make a difference?
Yeah, I do. Objectively do. I objectively do. I think that there are a lot of siblings who don't get along. And I have seen siblings who are raised, you know, they're very close when they're younger and then they're more estranged. So I'm absolutely generalizing when I say this, because plenty of siblings are not close. Plenty of siblings deal with the fallout of death in a different way, and it doesn't jive in ways that fracture them. And there's the inheritance process, which, let me tell you, is not fun. It's not fun.
Thank God my siblings and I don't have that to worry about.
Yeah, great. like you know, like, hopefully it's only like three, as many chairs to split as there are.
Do you want mom's other deck of solitaire cards?
Right, exactly.
Gabby, so, you're also an only child.
I am also an only child. And so people ask me, is it harder? I mean, you know what? The truth is, I don't know. The truth is, I think probably yes, and probably no. Just having edited so many stories on the site, and we have more than 500 pieces on modernloss.com, I've come to understand just how complicated the process can be between siblings, just between people who love each other. You know, I guess I would have loved to have that support in an ideal world, but the only real answer I have for that is I don't know.
Tell us your story.
Okay, so Liel actually knows my story because 5 months after my father and stepmother were murdered in a robbery, which is the gist of that story, I took a job at a newspaper and somehow managed to function at that job. Sitting right next to Liel. So he knew me at total peak train wreck. So the story, the gist of which I just told you, was my dad and stepmother were murdered by a methamphetamine addict who had been sent by a local plumbing company to do plumbing work in their home. They had moved 18 months prior to Sedona, Arizona, which is actually, as opposed to the New Jersey Turnpike, a totally beautiful place to die, but, like, you're still dead. And so in the aftermath, I was just, you know, thrown into adulthood. I was about 2 years out of college by just all these things I had no reference point for. I mean, police and prosecutors, medical examiners, mortuaries, and my friends, who were, you know, also mostly 24, hadn't lost parents, let alone known anyone who had been murdered. And it became an incredibly isolating experience and just, like, also logistically challenging. I remember sitting next to Liel when I was, you know, 24, 25, and, like, trying to come up with ways to tell the person I had met, you know, on J-Date or wherever I was meeting people, or at the Oak Room or wherever we were going way back when, and I'm totally dating myself, that, like, this, like, terrible, horrible, no good thing had happened, but, like, hey, I've got no baggage, or, like, I'm totally fine, which was, you know, certainly not true. And the messaging was certainly not
My father was brutally murdered. Tell me about your family.
Yeah, exactly.
So many. Dad, right. Gabby and I could go on for hours about our dating stories, you know, just how you realize very quickly that people are allergic to this conversation, whether it's like a peaceful death at the end of life or whether it's a murder.
They don't
a lot
want to
of
hear
people,
about it.
Yeah, they all of a sudden have like an early earnings call in the morning.
Oh my God. But so the book is such an amazing extension of the site, and I'd love to know from each of you what your favorite part is. Like what contribution just you think sort of really, really moved you?
Gabby?
Okay. There's many. And it's really hard to pick one. There are 44 contributors in addition to Rebecca and myself who wrote extensively in the book. But two pieces that come to mind is one by Hallie Tanner, who is a novelist. And she talks about the right to hold grudges in the aftermath of losing someone you love. Like, grudges don't always serve us well, but in this case, she feels like this is righteous indignation. She makes a really funny comment about how people don't remember what they ate for lunch yesterday, but they remember 20 years later who didn't show up at the Shiva. Another piece, which is completely different, is by Jacqueline Mirakete. And she survived the Rwandan genocide, having lost her whole family, multiple siblings, both of her parents, her grandmother. And she speaks about returning to Rwanda for the first time in more than a decade out after the genocide. And she speaks to something so universal, like, thank God, like, most of us will not have to endure what she had to endure. But there are so many threads that anyone who has lost someone and had to return to a home that doesn't feel like a home will just totally get on this visceral level.
That's amazing. Thank you. Rebecca.
I would say that some of my favorite pieces in the book, which are all of them really, because, you know, this book, we're so proud of it. And we're so proud of the contributors who said yes and shared stories that stemmed from the hardest things that, you know, they've, you know, some of the hardest things they've ever dealt with. You know, I just want to say, like, this book is actually really funny, you know, because loss is kind of ridiculously hysterical sometimes. It is, because life is messy. Death is messy. Like, one of the funniest things that happened, you know, like, happened at my mother's funeral, where they put the wrong shade of lipstick on her and I had to scrub it off her corpse and put the right shade on because I didn't want her looking like Tammy Faye for all eternity. But I would say some of my favorite pieces are the ones that are counterintuitive to what you would think the experience of loss would be. An example is the writer Emily Rapp Black, who wrote this beautiful book called The Still Point of the Turning World. She lost her son Ronan when he was three to Tay-Sachs. And in her piece, she writes, her piece is called Meet the Twins, Grief and Desire. What I love about it is you conjure up the image of a grieving young mother. You think of, like, maybe she's hiding behind a mantilla, you know, like she's shrouding all the mirrors. You know, the child's room is like cloaked in darkness. And, you know, her lead is, after my son Ronan died, all I wanted to do was write and fuck. And I love that because it's real. She's being honest. She's like, don't make me the, you know, like the like la madre, like the, you know, like the holy, you know, right, bereaved mother, because I am that. But also, like, I need to connect physically and carnally with people to move through this awful thing that I'm going through. And it's great because I think it kind of gives voice to the flip side of what you think it would be.
And possibly also to take her mind off it.
And possibly also
escapism, right?
Maybe for a minute, you know? Yeah. And I think, like, another one last piece, and maybe Gabby and I can both.
I love that we asked you for one, you both come with two. That's awesome. but that's how great the book is. So, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there's so many. I just, like, we love, it's like our babies. Like, we love them all. We love all these writers. And I would say, like, one of our favorite pieces is, you know, one we wrote ourselves. It's called A Brief Guide to Grief Speak. And, you know, the reason we love this
piece. Give us an example of what, because this was actually one of my favorite.
I mean, we love this piece mostly not because, like, we think we're geniuses, but because we wrote it both when I personally was, like, out of my mind, exhausted and somewhat maybe drunk at late at night, because, you know, like, I was just thinking of, like, what are the real terms? You know, it's not DSM 4 or 5 terms. It's this. It's, okay, edible arrangement, fruit skewers whittled into floral bouquets, frequently received en masse in lieu of actual comfort, may contain a marshmallow at the center. And then my personal favorite, because this is the way it is closure, a myth perpetuated by people who don't know what the fuck they're talking about.
I've always hated the word closure. I'm so happy you brought that up. Yeah. Rebecca Sofer and Gabby Bergner are the co-founders of Modern Loss, which aims to make conversations about grief more candid. It's a website at modernloss.com. Their book, Modern Loss, Candid Conversations About Grief, Beginner's Welcome, was published in January and will be in print forever.
And the good thing is, it's actually the perfect thing to give to the person you don't know what to say to.
Yes.
It's better than an edible arrangement.
I was going to say, it's better than a shrink wrap.
They attract fruit flies.
And also, like, Shivas always have too much food. And it's like, how do you deal with that? That what you've done is essentially created a cleaning problem for the people who have the biggest problem in the world.
Right.
Amazing.
Yeah. So one of our writers called it a support group in book form. So you're like handing someone a support group.
But That's also what the website
it is. You know. And you can visit it at 2 a.m., you know.
That's right. Thanks, guys.
Into each life some rain must fall, but too much is falling in mine. Into each heart some tears must fall, but someday the sun will shine.
Mazel tovs. Leo, do you have a mazel tov this week?
Yeah, mazel tov to our friend Jen Senior, who was just appointed to be an opinion writer and podcaster at the failing New York Times. And she will make them so much better.
She will save them. Basically, Jen Senior is going to save them.
She is happy, high energy, which is the opposite of sad, low energy.
Stephanie Budnick.
I have some Mazel Tovs here. I have one to Ethan Gross and Mindy Rappaport, who I remember we announced their engagement, I think, on our wedding episode last year. Mm-hmm. And their friend Leo wrote in to tell us that they actually got married this past weekend.
It's nice when an engagement actually leads to a wedding.
I love it when a plan comes together.
And we have another one, a special one. Naomi Turim became a bat mitzvah on June 23rd in Northwood, UK. Her mother and her rabbi are dedicated unorthodox Knicks. And I may have just butchered their last name, and I apologize.
The important thing is that now that she's a woman, she too can become an unorthodox Knick.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what that's... that.
13 is the age of listening.
That's right. Naomi Mishnah says that 13 is the age of listening.
Although she's 12, presumably.
Presumably. Yeah. Well, Naomi, the important thing is that now that you're a woman, you need a podcasting life. You need a podcasting regimen and ritual.
And we're it.
This is basically Hebrew high school.
That's right. We would like unorthodox. Could you, if you listen to our podcast a lot, you learn so much more than at most.
Oh, absolutely.
Hebrew high school.
So you should send us the money that you foolishly spend on
absolutely
day school.
Absolutely.
Did I ever tell you guys about my Monday-Wednesday migraines, which coincided with Hebrew school? Then I switched out of like Gimel 1 into Gimel 4 from the top to like the lowest. And it was just
the migraines.
I was so happy always with all my friends. Here, I'm fine.
The migraines went away.
I think I'm fine.
You were Gimel 4? If only Mora Chava could see you now.
My Mazel Tov is to tablet writer Wesley Yang, who I just think has been killing it lately in his pieces for us, in his piece for the New York Times opinion section about Harvard
devastating
admissions. I just think Wesley Yang is a really, really... He has a book coming out called The Souls of Yellow Folk, and I just think he's really killing it. Every time I read something by him, I am intrigued, provoked, moved, and y'all should go out and Google Wesley Yang and read some Yang. Unorthodox brought to you by Tablet Magazine, on the web at tabletmag.com. This week, we'd like to dedicate our show to the memory of Batsheva Novak, whose mother is a very, very dear friend of the show. You can write to us at unorthodox@tabletmag.com or leave us a voicemail at 914-570-4869. You can also ask for our newsletter by putting newsletter in the subject line. We often come to you live. To book us, email producer Josh Cross, that's Cross with a K, at jcross@tabletmag.com. Hit up bit.ly, that's bit.ly/unorthoshirt to find the latest in unorthodox gear. Follow us on Instagram at Unorthodox Podcast and on Twitter at Unorthodox_pod. Follow Stephanie on Instagram at sbutnick. Join our Facebook group. Our show is produced by Josh Cross and Shira Telushkin. It is edited by Noah Levinson. Our artwork is by Esther Werdiger. Our theme music is by Golem. Rabbinic supervision this week by Rabbi Johanna Kinberg of Kol Ami in Woodinville, Washington, a tireless soldier in the fight against injustice. If you would like to nominate your rabbi to offer rabbinic supervision, write to me at moppenheimer@tabletmag.com. We recorded Argo Studios, which refuses to serve Sarah Huckabee Sanders, and we're part to be proud of the Panoply Network.
Wait, you said you're part to be proud of the Panoply Network.
And we're Panoply to be part of the proud network. Shalom, friends.